hear it.
And I've been swearing I wouldn't keep telling this story, but it's unavoidable. I've got the probably the world's expert here on what's out at Area 51 or what is not. Coming home one night, late at night, about 2 years ago now, my wife, it was dark, there was about three quarters of a moon, and we were about a mile away from our house, so I won't identify specifically where it was. But here in the Paramali, and my wife turned around and said, "What the hell's that?" She said, "What's that? Stop the car." And so I stopped the car and got out of the car and looked up, and here coming from behind us, and I'm to give you the setting, it was a quiet night. You could hear crickets going at a quarter mile away easily. I mean, dead, flat, quiet as it is out here. And coming up from behind us, from roughly a east-southeast direction, was this triangular craft about 150 feet in the air above us. There was enough light with, you know, three-quarter moon or better, so you could see the substance of this craft. That's how close it was, no more than 150 feet above. And approaching our automobile quickly, it was toward the, west-northwest. And so we just stood there, and it flew above us. Floated. It didn't make a sound. I would estimate 150 feet at least from one edge of the triangle to the next. There was a flashing red light in the front and two white solid lights on the back edge of each triangle point. It was awesome. I was in the Air Force. I know what an aircraft is, and I know what aerodynamic flight is, and I know what it takes to power an aircraft. This thing floated at a very slow speed directly above our heads. And we stood there, and the both of us watched it float directly across the valley until finally it was out of sight. It was a remarkable story, and it was a couple of weeks later, somebody sent me a newspaper clipping from my very own paper here in Pahrump, saying the Air Force had many inquiries, and yes, they admitted there was a secret mission involving a C-130. That flew low over the Pahrump Valley. And that was the totality of the explanation from Nellis Air Force Base. Now, that's an insult. I flew C-130s. It would have rattled my bones at that distance. There's no question about what I saw. I saw it. My wife saw it. I put her on the air, made her go on the air, and back me up. Well, this last week, I talked to two other individuals refusing to go on the air, both who live here in Pahrump, who confirmed that night they also saw it. But I'm telling you, that's what I saw. Glenn, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, that's what I saw. There was no mistaking it. It was not a light in the sky. It was a lot more than that. It was close to me. Either it's technology that we don't even have a hint about, or it's something from someplace else. I wouldn't know either way. But have you heard reports of that?
I'm in the same position that you are. I just don't know. Now, the point that I would focus in on is not the object itself, but the reaction from the Air Force. Now, if the Air Force is telling you what essentially sounds like a cover story, that certainly implies an Air Force involvement.
Correct.
And that's the sort of thing you can track down much more easily than you can track down the object itself. If you're out in the desert and you see something unusual, what can you do? But if there's a human link to it, That's the sort of thing you can explore.
Well, I've never seen any UFOs before. Oh, I've seen lights. I guess most of us have. But, Glenn, this was close. It was very close. There was no mistaking then nor now what I saw, as I described to you, close enough so that, you know, you could see the actual substance of the craft. And it was just a dead triangle. No, it couldn't have been an F-117 or anything like that. And it was gigantic. Now, doggone it, I saw it. I've never seen any other, and I don't know if I would like to see one again.
But it certainly changed you. I can sense this.
Yeah, it did. It did change me. It did, because I now know we're either generations ahead of where we say we are right now, or we're being visited. One of the two is true.
And the whole thing that really fascinates me and how I differ from others is that I'm not looking at the objects in the sky. I am more interested in you and your reaction and how humanity reacts to this whole phenomenon. Because I think this is key to whether and how the truth comes out is how we are willing to respond to it, whether humanity has the maturity to respond to it and absorb it into our worldview.
My guess is no.
No?
Yeah.
Well, we've absorbed bigger things, I think, like world wars are certainly upsetting to humanity.
Yes, but they're not upsetting to religious belief.
Well, I guess my analogy would be to an island kingdom that has had no contact with white people or with outside culture, and this culture, this new explorer's land on the shore of this island. It may be a traumatic experience, but the islanders do adjust, provided they're not overwhelmed by the invaders. Nothing I see indicates that the aliens are evil in any way or are out to take us over. They obviously, if they had that intention, they would have done that long ago. They would have blown us out of the solar system.
Let's center back on Area 51. In your Area 51 viewer's guide, right on, I don't know, page 1 or page 2, page 1, I think, it says, "Warning! Freedom Ridge and White Sides are now closed." And you warn people, you go up into these areas and you're going to get arrested. Is that right?
It's a great danger because the border is very, very poorly marked. These, by the way, are the hills that people used to climb up to look down on the secret base. What you saw in the distance looked like an average Air Force base. It's not much different from Nellis, looking down on Nellis Air Force Base.
Well, except that it's not supposed to be there. And
it doesn't exist.
So you're not allowed to go to this particular viewing point anymore, and if you do, what happens?
Oh, you'd be arrested. I don't think you'd be shot, but you'd certainly get the full treatment. They would not be kind. And it results generally in a $600 fine.
$600?
Well, you can afford it, perhaps. We can just give it a try.
Well, have you? I take it that during the time it was legal for you to do so, you have.
Well, I've certainly been up there hundred times, perhaps.
100 times.
And never seen anything, aside from some MiG aircraft, which perhaps I wasn't supposed to see.
MiG aircraft?
This is, among other things, Area 51 has been where we keep our Russian arsenal, the aircraft that we have purloined in various ways from the Soviets. It's our Red Hat Squadron, as it's called.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. Well, there are a lot of different earthly projects going on at Area 51, enough to account for the number of people who go out there. The MiG, certainly UAVs, this is unmanned aerial vehicles designed for reconnaissance. They have been tested there. Very small weaponry might be tested there, and certainly stealth aircraft like the B-2 continue to return there for various forms of radar testing.
Mm-hmm. There is another, I'm trying to give them the practical now, there is a place you can go for those who don't feel they can afford the $600 called Tikaboo Peak, is that correct?
There remains a number of distant mountains that you can climb to again see the base but from a much greater distance. This would be 25 miles, which across the desert, you can still see the base, but you're going to need a pretty good telescope to see very much. Tikaboo Peak, for example, is an 8,000-foot peak. It takes it's a strenuous 2-hour hike to get to it.
Mm.
You can't get there in the winter when it's snowed in. But if you're willing to take this hike, you can see the base. And it might be a better viewpoint in some ways than the Freedom Ridge viewpoint, because whenever anyone was in Freedom Ridge, the guards would report right back that someone's there.
Mm-hmm.
And as they say, watchdog goes into effect, meaning that they will call off secret aircraft and suppress operations while you're there.
Huh. And so they've annexed that now, correct? In other words,
correct.
You can no longer go up there. And one can only wonder if operations, really secret stuff, or even the saucers, have been transferred elsewhere. Well, then why are they doing that?
Well, you can certainly speculate endlessly about where the saucers have been transferred, if they have been. Again, Area 51, the base itself, the physical hangars that you see in these photos, this is almost, has always been exclusively a conventional base. The Bob Lazar says that. He says there is nothing at Area 51. Mm. He saw his stuff south of Area 51. Now, as for whether the stuff has been moved, sure, you can move it. You can move something secret at any time. But you can't wipe out a history of a place. You can't wipe out all traces of it. And this is the sort of thing that will continue to stay in the minds of workers, for example. There'll continue to be paperwork involved in it. And that's the sort of thing that I'm trying to track down.
All right. For the less adventuresome, I doubt I'd hike up for a couple of hours. There is the black mailbox. And where is that? And on what road? And if people wanted to find it, go to the infamous black mailbox. You might tell them about that.
Well, this is, I call it a sacred site, a religious site. there is a mailbox, a rancher's mailbox on this lonely Highway 375, where because this is the only landmark in a very long stretch of empty highway, this is where the UFO believers gathered to look for UFOs. I personally try to stay away from that because it's become such a social center, and I believe that the government is at all wise would not put on a display for people who just happen to show up.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the place where the true believers go and to look for UFOs, and as I say, when they're looking for, they see them because there's a lot of lights in the sky that could be ambiguous.
When is a good time to go? I'm sure you get that question all the time.
Again and again, and I come right back to the fact, I think that the moment that Bob Lazar came forward with his story, saying that the UFOs are real, I think they would have changed their operations in such a way that they're not going to put them on display for tourists. So I think that no time is a good time. It's a fascinating area. It's a great place to gaze at the stars because you have no light pollution up there, and you can see things for 100 miles that you just can't see in the big city. But I don't think you should go there expecting to see UFOs.
What kind of security people? I mean, if you violated this, went up to Freedom Ridge, had a camera with you, and so forth, and they closed in on you, are these plainclothes people who meet you? Sort of security service, or what can you tell us about that?
These are camouflage-clad security guys with no name tags, no insignia.
Really?
The best information is that they work for a government contractor, EG&G, but they will not identify themselves. They will not identify who they work for. And if you try to approach them, they'll certainly run away. It's a very curious phenomenon. However, if you stick your big toe across that line, you're suddenly going to find a whole lot of them surrounding you, and they will not be gentle. Generally, this means face down in the dirt,
yes.
And you're probably there for an hour or so until they call the local sheriff, who eventually hauls you off and charges you.
All right, I'm a scanner nut. I love scanners, and I've got the BC2500 XLT unit in Bearcat. It has the advantage of covering lots of military frequencies, and I notice that in your book, you list the military frequencies up in that area, even one called Dreamland Control. Are those accurate frequencies?
They are probably not accurate as printed in the book, because they were changed recently. Whenever the frequencies get published, of course they change. But many of these frequencies are in the clear. You can trace, you can pick up the Groom Lake Tower, for example, or this Dreamland Control frequency, which would be controlling a military aircraft in and out.
Do you know what the new one is?
I'm not, there's some that I simply don't talk about, because the moment I say them on the air, they're not going to be valid anymore.
It's true. I'm going to have to get you at a quiet moment. Hold on just one moment. We're talking with, and soon you'll be able to, Glenn Campbell, who is probably the world's expert on Area 51. He'll be back in a moment. North American Trading has done a very...
Mention the unit of aircraft, XLT 2500. You might check with Bob Crane and see if he's got any of those in stock. Like some UHF or VHF antennas. And it says Area 51 Research Center. Now, I'm guessing, but if somebody came by Rachel and they're interested in this sort of thing, I'll bet you've had 10 million knocks on that door, haven't you?
An awful lot. A lot of fascinating people. I'm not there most of the time. However, at the present, I'm living most of the time in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
But this has resulted in an awful lot of contacts just being known for this. And my job is to pull together this information and make it available to others.
And so you do take time out and talk to people who stop by and see you?
I consider myself sort of a networker. And my job is simply to connect people together and pull information together from various people. And mm-hmm. I certainly talk to people as much as I can.
So even though you weren't, while you were living there, getting direct sightings, you just thought you were in the right place to be gathering information about it?
It was the center of the universe.
The center of the universe. Where do you go from here, Glenn? In other words, in continuing trying to research this, what's next?
My job, as I see it, is to build a base of information. I do this principally on the Internet, building up my section on the World Wide Web, so that any information that I have that comes into me becomes available to anyone else who wants it.
Boy, it is a wonderful resource, isn't it?
It is.
All right. Well, what I'm going to do is, when we get back, I'll let you give out your web address, if you would like, and we'll also tell people how to get... And there's a lot of good information in the Area 51 Viewer's Guide. Tells you how to get there, what to watch out for, what to be careful of, what you might see, where you might best see it, how to avoid getting arrested, all kinds of cool things about Area 51. That is the topic. Glenn Campbell, my guest. You're listening to Dreamland. To the numbers. We're about to open the phone lines.
From the Kingdom of Nine, you're hearing Dreamland with Art Bell. To participate in the program, call toll-free 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. First-time callers, area code 702-727-1222. Or the wildcard line at 702-727-1295. This is the CBC Radio Network.
Free radicals, bad guys. They enter your body through the air, the water. Now to Glenn Campbell, a fax from Dick in Honolulu. Glenn, great show. Please tell Glenn thanks for his great Desert Rat Online newsletter. It is very well written and it's entertaining. Please ask Glenn to tell us more about, is it Jared, the alleged worker, like Bob Lazar, who tells of working on the UFO simulator. Just before we do that, give out your web address for the Internet junkies out there and tell them how to get your Area 51 viewer's guide.
Okay, the web address is, I will give out this long address, but if anyone doesn't write it down, you can usually find my page simply by looking for any UFO page and jumping through it to find mine.
Rather than giving the actual address, I think that's a better way to go. Give us a keyword when you get to the web search.
Well, certainly you can search for UFOs. That will bring you to a major UFO page, and from there, there are links to my page. This is the wonder of the World Wide Web. You don't have to remember these addresses.
Somewhere in your web address is Glenn Campbell, or what?
You will find the... the web address, probably the key to search for would be Desert Rat.
There you go.
There you are, and you will find me.
All right, Desert Rat.
And from there, you will find all sorts of fascinating information about Area 51, including back issues of the newsletter, all available for free.
God, it's such a wonderful, really, available for free?
That's the way the web works. Information was meant to be free.
Area 51 Viewer's Guide, that is not free. You published that, correct?
No, that is a self-published book. It is available for $15. from the Area 51 Research Center in Rachel, Nevada, 89001. You don't even need a street address because the postman knows me. And you'll have to enclose $4 additional for priority mail or air mail to Canada. So that's $19 total.
If you want a priority or air mail.
No, no, that's the only way we send it out.
Okay, so it's the total then is 19 bucks.
19 bucks plus a dollar tax if you're in Nevada.
How would you sum up the Area 51 Viewer's Guide? Kind of the way I did, as though it leads you around all the pitfalls and...
It is basically a base of information. This is recording basically the first year of my stay in Rachel. Basically, I collected geographical information. I collected references, all the printed references that I could find to the area, and those all went into the book. It's a bit paradoxical, in fact, because I'm not saying that you're going to find UFOs there. I say this is an interesting place to visit just for its own sake. It's an interesting desert locale and for historical reasons. But the viewer's guide is a little bit more than that. It is a base of information that may get you started in your own research into Area 51.
That's good. All right, I'm going to ask you a question that you really don't have to answer, but I am curious, and then we'll get on to this other question. You've had all these people knock on your door during the time that you were up there a lot and in contact with you. What percentage of the people that you've connected with would you consider to be missing a couple of cards from the deck?
Well, there's a whole spectrum there. There are some, I have been visited by a number of aliens, space aliens, in fact, that will tell me that they come from all different star systems, from Draconis, from the Pleiades, from various planets here on in our solar system. And my inclination is to say they've got a screw loose, but I stop short of that. I say that really how I evaluate a person is on their human skills, and most of these aliens don't have those human skills. But there is a great spectrum. There's very reliable people who I can tell after talking with shortly that what they're saying has great credibility. There's the rest of the majority of people, for example, who report things to me, I have to take with a grain of salt because I don't know them. I don't understand their mental processes. And this is something you have to get involved with as a UFO researcher. You have to understand the people that you're talking to and how their perception works.
Well, that was very diplomatic. Would you say 50-50 or?
As I say, well, let's say there's 2% who are real loons.
And
2% who are extremely reliable, who talk with extreme precision. And everyone else fits into sort of a gray area. Good information can come from anywhere in the spectrum. You just have to be willing to filter out whatever noise that this person is producing internally.
All right, now, Jared, whoever Jared is.
Okay, that's pronounced J-Rod.
J-Rod, I'm sorry.
This is a former government worker who I've reported on in my Desert Rat newsletter. He is 70 years old. He claims to have worked in essentially the same type of program that another aspect of the same program that Lazar was supposedly involved with.
Well, now this is really important. I had never heard this, and this is cooperation then for Lazar. How well do their stories mesh?
They don't mesh exactly, but they mesh well enough to say, well, if this is real, then they reflect upon each other. But I like all these stories, I stop short of saying, it's completely real. I'm at the stage of I'm investigating something. I want to collect the facts. I want to see how the facts mesh together before I make a judgment. And I think that if you collect and organize the data right, the solution will show itself. You don't have to make a decision. You don't have to force a belief upon it. Anyway, I can tell you a little bit about this man's story. He claims to have worked with, to have designed certain components of a simulator which a flight simulator trained pilots to fly flying discs we have reproduced from alien technology.
No kidding.
Now, okay.
No kidding. That really is interesting.
Story, but again, anyone can tell a story.
Well, okay, now comes the assessment of J-Rod, is it? You learned
You talk to this human being. He's in his 70s. How does he strike you?
He strikes me as any engineer in his 70s who certainly has the technical ability, like Lazar. I have not necessarily tried to verify his educational background.
Okay, but not necessarily in the 2% of loonies, certainly.
No, I would regard him as the 2% of people who are reliable.
Well, that's pretty strong.
But again, I talk to him just as another human being. I'm interested in the story. I'm interested in collecting the story, working out the details, and seeing how they mesh with other stories that I know. And I call this folklore. I call this collecting, like you collect an old rancher's story or anybody else's story. You want to understand the story first of all and collect its many details. Like Lazar's story, it's a story that's rich in details, and it goes back to these alleged UFO crashes that took place in the 40s and 50s.
Roswell, etc.
Maybe there's some that we don't know about that were effectively covered up. If any of that is true, if we recovered hardware, what happened then? And this is where J. Rod's story picks up. He says that, in fact, we picked up hardware, we picked up bodies, and we also picked up a few live ones, a few live aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the basic story that resulted in a portion of our government having contact with the aliens. So it makes a great story, true or false. It makes a great story that could make its way into Hollywood at some point, you know. This is the sort of thing I pursue, and I pursue it by a different tact than most people would say. Most people would say the moment you've mentioned a story like that, well, have you checked his credentials? Have you nailed down everything about his past? And I've done some basic work there, but no, I haven't. I look at the man himself and say, is this somebody I trust? Do I understand how his mind works?
Why did he come forward? Did he tell you that?
Again, another very interesting thing. He says he's been given permission to talk.
Really?
Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that...
I would presume that even Glenn Campbell must wonder, well, does that mean that Glenn Campbell is going to be used as a flashpoint to disseminate disinformation, or just to muddy the waters out there somehow? Or does it mean that Glenn Campbell has been appointed to disseminate information about what's really going on?
Well, in either case, I don't believe that I was chosen specifically. I think I sort of stumbled upon this person through other contacts.
Huh.
But we've hit it off. We get along all right. I see him every now and then.
Is he willing to go public beyond his communication with you?
No, and this is the point where we give him this name of J-Rod. That is not his real name.
Oh, okay.
And it's interesting. We're not trying to protect him here from the government.
I know. Listen, I don't blame him. In his position, I wouldn't do it either. The press would descend on him. Life would change.
And Bob Lazar is the best
example.
Best proof of that.
No,
suddenly,
it's true.
As soon as Bob Lazar came forward with his story, suddenly people were camping on his front lawn.
Yes.
And saw him as the new Messiah.
Yes, I know.
And that is the problem. As I say, the problem, I think, with the whole UFO field is not government disinformation. It's not the government muddying the waters. It is the UFO believers muddying the waters themselves.
Oh, I agree. Stand by just a second, Glenn. We'll come right back to you. And then the phone, by the way, the East of the Rockies line is 1-800-825-5033. We're going to take calls in a moment, I promise. 1-800-825-5033. Dreamland, talking about Dreamland. If you want to learn Ontario, all right, what? How can we help you?
Well, I just wanted to check if I could get through.
You can.
You what? Did? You mean that's the whole purpose, just to see if you could get through?
Any question at all. Shoot.
Okay. I heard about that jet that they were making, like that could go over, how many miles is that?
Oh, you're talking about the Aurora.
Yeah.
All right, that's a good one. What about it? Is the Aurora real?
Ah, there's another vague UFO story. I don't know if it's real. What we're talking about is a hypersonic aircraft presumably the fastest in the world, anywhere from Mach 4 to Mach 7, that was supposedly under development by the Air Force to replace the SR-71, which was mysteriously retired earlier in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, does the government have such a plane? And to this day, I do not know. There was certainly a project in the works to build such a plane. Whether it got off the ground, whether it was flown at Groom Lake, I just don't know.
Would you think it would represent the next logical generation?
It would, but what makes me skeptical of this is if we're talking about solely human technology, this is something that's incredibly expensive. Think of all the billions and billions that were poured into the stealth bomber, for example. A hypersonic aircraft is going to be just as expensive, and billions that have to come out of a budget someplace.
While we're on the subject of budgets and very expensive aircraft, the report on the B-2 the other day was pretty pathetic from the GAO. It said the B-2 failed tests regarding whether it would be shot down, failed tests regarding whether it was even stealth, in other words, it can be seen on radar, and generally failed most of its tests, according to the GAO.
This is an indictment of how our black budget aircraft development works. It is the sort of thing that, all UFOs aside, the reason that you cannot let the government do anything it wants with money. It has to be held accountable as the project is proceeding. Make sure that the taxpayer gets the bang for its buck and these billions that we're spending. I think this is a symptom of exactly the sort of thing that we're trying to change here, to get more accountability.
Of course, on the other hand, the F-117 is generally considered to be a big success.
Indeed.
But
the fact that it was secret, the fact that it was non-existent, was that really necessary? Did that give us the edge?
Getting down to the nitty-gritty, well, the F-117 certainly has, and did in the Iraq War. But getting...
But could Saddam have reproduced it?
Well, I don't know. Getting down to the nitty-gritty, do you think Freedom Ridge should be available to the public, that the government was wrong to close it up, or do you understand the need for national security when it comes to developing aircraft?
This is always a very delicate issue. There's certainly a need for secrecy in defense. It is probably the most essential element. You don't want to tell your potential adversaries just what you have, just what your troop strength is. But there is also a need for accountability, and there is this constant push and pull, this balance that has to be struck. What I am saying is that there has to be another force. The military is always pushing for more secrecy. There has to be another force that is pushing for greater openness.
And you are the openness force.
That is my job, like an advocate for a certain position.
Well,
yes.
May the force be with you then. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Glenn Campbell. Hi. Hello.
Hi, I'm calling from KSFO in San Francisco.
Yes, sir.
About 3 years ago, I went out and videotaped a thing at the Little Early Inn. It was a meeting with put on by Norio Hayakawa and Gary Schultz. Bill Cooper showed up, John Lear showed up, Bob Lazar showed up, and then a group of us went out and hiked up to, I guess it was Freedom Ridge. It was about 5, maybe 10 miles away.
Yeah, that was Whiteside at the time. That was before Freedom Ridge was discovered.
Oh, Whiteside, okay.
Yeah.
And we sat up there and just watched things come and go all night. Different aircraft. It was all pretty conventional. We watched the Jeeps come out to the edge of the fence, and every time we got a little too loud, it was obvious they knew we were there. We saw Old Faithful come in about 5 in the morning. The interesting thing to me was that the meeting itself at the Little Alien, one of the big things they discussed was the possibility of genetic experiments going on underground at Area 51. And I'm wondering if Lazar or any of the other people you've run into have alluded to it. I know John Lear has a little bit.
Well,
all right.
Let me ask you something. When you were recording this event and they were discussing these genetic experiments, what was Bob Lazar doing? Was he sitting at the bar?
Sitting in the audience, just observing.
Yes. Now, I, knowing Bob, I would think that he would regard that as pretty ridiculous. Bob is a very nuts and bolts guy. He'll say, this is what I experienced, and this is all I know.
Right, and he refuses. I'm one of the lucky few that has been able to interview Bob Lazar. And you're quite correct. The moment anybody gets off into the deep end, Bob will stop and say, look, I don't know anything about that. I don't even want to speculate about it. Here's what I did. As you said, he's a nuts and bolts kind of guy. To me, that's always made him quite believable. You sort of stay away from the social UFO. I don't want to use the word cults, but...
I want to stay away, separate what is the evidence from what is the interpretation of the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Lazar's story is evidence. It's either false evidence or true evidence. But upon this, people have piled their whole belief systems and piled on their whole baggage that they want to believe, the things that they want to believe. And I think Bob is right in just sticking with the facts. But you've got a million different interpretations of those facts that are really muddying the waters more than anything else.
It really brushes up against, almost for some, being a religion, doesn't it? In other words, they want to believe in this so much.
Absolutely. This is no different than humans have been all through the generations. They want to believe certain things, and they will believe those things regardless of what the evidence is.
An article of faith. And that's just like a religion. And that's not far from a cult.
Indeed.
And there are some out there who say they are ufologists who might almost be thought of as cult leaders.
That's right. But a cult leader can only work if there are willing followers. And there certainly are plenty of willing followers. This is something that Area 51 has taught me, that there are people... There are certainly skeptics out there, people who will disbelieve no matter what. But there's also the true believers who will believe no matter what, and they will believe anything connected with UFOs.
All right, Glenn, stay right there. We'll be right back to you. I have seen one of that. I know it. It gives me no sort of faith in anything, but I do know what I saw. We'll be back with more from the high desert in a moment. This is CBC.